Over NBC's Coast to Coast network of independent affiliated stations, the University of Chicago Roundtable. Today, the Roundtable continues its important series on problems of Asia with a report on Communist China, the fifth in a series of programs about Asia. To begin today's discussion of Communist China, we present Phillips Talbot, authority on Southeast Asia and a senior associate of the Institute of Current World Affairs. And now, Mr. Talbot.
American soldiers are now fighting north of the 38th parallel in Korea. Last week, the Communist Chinese leaders announced that they would not tolerate the defeat of the North Koreans. But what is this Communist China that we now face? We have had a lot of argument in America about Chiang Kai-shek, Mao Zedong, and the seating of Communist China or Nationalist China in the United Nations. But we know very little about Communist China, what it is, the failures, the successes, and what is happening there. In an effort to seek out the important things about Communist China today, there are taking part with me in today's University of Chicago Roundtable two Americans who have studied China intensively. Albert Ravenholt returned from China and Southeast Asia only 3 weeks ago. A foreign correspondent in the Far East during the war, he went back to China in 1948 as a correspondent of the Chicago Daily News and an associate of the Institute of Current World Affairs. He visited large cities and small villages in central, west, and south China and covered the fall of Nanking and Shanghai to communist forces. Ravenholt, are the Chinese now copying the Russian Revolution?
Not exactly. The Russians came to power in a somewhat different fashion. About 200,000 more or less Bolsheviks in Russia seized control of the big cities, the lines of communication, and then set out to fight a civil war and to make a revolution. In China, the Chinese communists took the cities and the lines of communication last. Before they got there, they had already organized their revolution in the countryside of North China. That means, in effect, that by the time they established their dictatorship, they had achieved a broader base for that dictatorship than the Russians had when they came to power.
Also taking part in today's Chicago Roundtable is Professor Derek Bada of the University of Pennsylvania. Bada lived in China as a boy and returned in 1931 to study on a Harvard Yenching Institute fellowship until 1937. A student of Chinese language and philosophy, he went out once again in 1948 as a Fulbright scholar and lived in Peking first in the last days of Kuomintang rule and then for 7 months after the communists took control. His book, Peking Diary, a record of those experiences, is to be published in a few weeks. Bada, what kind of country are the communists trying to organize?
Well, there are several points to be kept in mind. First, the fact that there have been decades of war and no really unified country in recent times. Secondly, the fact that there has not been a long democratic tradition in China, as there has been in the West, but a tradition of rule by a ruling group, which in a way makes the task of a Chinese communist easier today. And thirdly, the fact that there have been strong family ties, which the communists are now trying to change into allegiance to a centralized state.
Is this a completed revolution, Ravenholt?
No, I think we have to make a very clear distinction in our own minds between the areas of China where the communists have really applied the revolution and where they're just getting started. The revolution so far has been carried out in a fairly small area totaling about one-fourth of China, in the northern and central part of China, north of the Yangtze River. In that area, the Chinese communists have, to use their term, turned over the society.
Does this mean that they have done the agrarian reform of which we hear so much?
That's correct. That is, they've used land reform as a tool to eliminate the old social groups and the old political groups who control the society and to bring into being a new social order which is patterned along the lines that they intend to make over the rest of China.
One of the things, Ravenholt, which has often been charged to the Chinese communists, is that they are agrarian reformers and merely agrarian reformers. Is that correct?
I think the Chinese communists would be the first to disagree with you. That is, the Chinese communists see their job simply as using the tools that are available in the countryside to achieve a base for carrying through a total reorganization of the society.
And what they're doing at present is a means towards an end. The present stage of land reform they themselves recognize is only the first step, which will go on eventually to collectivization.
I think we have to keep in mind also that this revolution, in its essential terms, is only being carried out in a small area of China now. The large areas of South China, West China, and Northwest China are in effect today ruled by the Chinese Communist armies who hold powers in those areas. So So whereas you have considerable popularity for the new government in certain areas of North China, where the revolution has been carried through, in South China, West China, Northwest China, you may have as much as 90% of the people violently opposing the new regime.
One of the problems that other revolutionary movements in other parts of Asia have faced is that they have a small core of people who are very enthusiastic about the revolution, but when they get governmental responsibility, they find they don't have nearly enough people to actually run the revolution.
Well, the biggest bottleneck in the communist revolution at the present time is their lack of enough political workers. To turn over the society, using their term, takes individual young Chinese men and women who will go out in the village and try to implement the new communist reforms, try to implement a new communist order. In some cases, they have had to scratch the bottom of the barrel and take in students of others and train them rapidly in a few weeks' time and send them south. In areas of South China, such as Jiangxi province, the farmers have killed some of these students who were coming out trying to tell them how good the new communist government was, when those farmers didn't agree with them.
Bada, as a person concerned with Chinese philosophy, I wonder what your experience is in terms of the religious program and convictions of the communists.
The communists have a Marxist attitude towards religion. They say that religion is a part of the old feudalistic society, which eventually will be done away with, but, they say, by means of education, not by violence. In other words, they permit religious tolerance, religious freedom, but they themselves are also free to make propaganda against it. That is the present situation. As far as the Chinese people themselves are concerned, I think that question of religious freedom doesn't rank as large in their minds as it does in the minds of us Westerners. Religion has not been a dominant factor in their lives for quite a long while.
It's also my impression that the Chinese communists make distinctions between various kinds of religion. For example, they've classified the Mohammedans in northwest China as a minority and give them special consideration.
In so doing, they followed the Kuomintang point of view.
That's true, yes. And also they classified various religious groups according to the extent to which the communists believe they might prove useful in the communist efforts to make over the country.
You gentlemen have spoken about agrarian things, about education, about religion. The thing that concerns me is some of the basic problems which any government of China must face. The problem of production, but particularly in this year, owing to the reports we have had, the problem of the famine in China and how that affects the communist position.
I think, in a sense, that's perhaps the overwhelming consideration in the minds of a great number of Chinese state and of the communist government as well. We had last winter a very severe famine, probably the worst since 1878. In 1878, 15 million people died. We don't know how many people died last winter. But the famine resulted essentially from a combination for the first time in this century of a large flood in the Yangtze River and a drought followed by a flood in the northern plains of China. The result of that was that there was extensive starvation. 32 million people starved, for example, in one area last winter. And it's been followed now this summer by another flood followed by drought in certain areas and the reverse in the central China plain. It means that we're going to have an even worse famine next winter than we had last winter.
How many people did you say starved in one area?
Last winter, last February, 32 million people were off the grain diet in northern Jiangsu, southern Shandong, and northern Anhui. That means that they had to live from February until this summer on roots, whatever they could scrape up.
Two things occur to me in respect to the famine. One is the political effect it may have. Can the Chinese communist regime survive what must be a major tragedy spreading over a very large part of the country?
The Chinese communists have made very energetic attempts to redistribute food throughout the country. That is, they've taken large amounts of food from Sichuan and brought it down to central China. In essence, the Chinese communists also have had to decide who was going to die. There was not enough food to go around, and they, in effect, have chosen to give first priority to the big cities, the army, the famine areas where there were literate groups, and other areas and communities within the country whom they considered valuable. That meant taking the food away from the peasants.
And letting them starve.
In effect, many of them had to starve, yes.
These taxes, I think it must have been confiscatory.
Well, for many years in China, land taxes have been collected in kind. In Sichuan province last winter, the Chinese communists collected taxes on rice, which were heavier than those within the memory of any person living. And the result of that, of course, was that you generated a great deal of resentment and hatred among many of the farmers. And you have at the present time, or had last spring, perhaps 400,000 so-called guerrillas, including some bandits who were opposing the communists in Sichuan province. Sichuan has about 60 million people.
But do you think, Ravenhold, that that is a serious problem as far as that resistance is concerned in Sichuan?
I don't think it's a serious challenge to communist authority, because the communists, for example, were able to take troops out of Sichuan and send them to Manchuria in spite of the fact that they had 400,000 guerrillas
right
in Sichuan.
In recent months, there have been suggestions by American mission groups and others that perhaps the United States might assist, not as a political measure, but in sending grain to China to keep people from starving.
I think the Chinese communists are perhaps would refuse to accept that aid. At least the Chinese communists are convinced today that if we give aid to China, it'll be given only to upset their government.
I may say that when I was there, they made open statements to the effect that they would not accept any aid if it came from the United States government.
That problem of the famine obviously is one of the serious problems facing the communist regime. I wonder if we can make a brief checklist of the failures and the successes that the communist regime has so far chalked up.
It's my impression, Delbert, that the first mistake the Chinese communists are making from a long-range point of view is the assumption on their part that they can copy Russia. The Russians came to power in an entirely different situation, that is, the Bolsheviks in Russia. They had large areas of undeveloped land, they had forest resources which had not been tapped, fisheries, etc. In China, there are no large potential natural resources that do not require heavy capital investment. Now, that means that in order to achieve increase in production, which is a fundamental problem in China, the communists must seek to be successful a different emphasis in their revolution than the Russians had to seek in their own country.
But on the other hand, isn't it true that they have followed a pattern in the past in China which was quite different from that followed in Russia, as I think you yourself said?
That's correct.
They worked out their program on the basis of empirical experience according to their own local conditions.
But I have detected, especially within the last year, a tendency, particularly among the more doctrinaire Chinese communists, to shift over in trying to solve their problems of industrialization to applying Russian techniques which may or may not be suitable to China.
Yes, I think that's true, particularly in the field of foreign relations, which we have
discussed. In the field of foreign
later.
Relations, yes.
But in some countries of Asia, there is a feeling that if only you can get rid of the landlords, then all the agrarian problems will be solved. I don't know where that feeling exists in China, but is it a valid expression in China?
No, I wouldn't say that it is. I think that among the higher-ups in the communist hierarchy, it is realized that the creation of a new social organization is only the first step towards solving their economic problems. However, among the lower Ganbu groups, the cadres, there is sometimes, I believe, the doctrinaire assumption that simply reform the society and automatically the economic situation will improve.
The professors and others I've talked to who've come out of China recently insist, and also from discussions with some communists, I get the distinct impression that the Chinese communists have not yet put to work on an extensive scale in China the scientific methods in farming which will be necessary if they're going to solve the problem of agricultural production.
This is definitely one of the mistakes the Chinese communists
well,
up to today.
They, at the present time, have not gotten around to doing it. They claim they're going to do it, but if they keep on delaying too long, they, in essence, today have a tiger by the tail, to use a Chinese term. That means they've got a hold of a society which has too many people for the amount of resources they have available. The Chinese communists have somehow got to solve the problem of how do you feed and provide for those people, and at the same time, they've promised to industrialize the country.
They are making certain steps, however, not in the way of scientific farming exactly, but in large-scale farming, particularly in Manchuria, the development of new lands there along cooperative lines.
True, but I think that those techniques and those methods are applicable only to Manchuria. That is, if we're going to solve the problem of increased agricultural production in China, it has to be done along lines that have not yet been devised. And in Manchuria, it's my understanding that they have, as a matter of fact, tried to copy Russian methods up there.
You see, from their point of view, they would say, indoctrinate the people, get them to accept these new forms, and then you can carry out those methods in China proper as well as in Manchuria.
Well, I asked a number of communist officers who happened to be captured at Jinmen Island whether or not they had been taught new methods of agriculture. They all agreed that China's basic problem was agricultural, but they themselves had not been taught any improved techniques of agriculture that they could apply either when they went home to their farms or even in the army while they were producing for the needs of the army in specific areas.
China's basic problem is, I have no doubt, agriculture, but I have yet to be in any Asian country where there isn't a dream that somehow the country can be industrialized and its problems solved that way.
Yes. Well, the Chinese communists certainly recognize very clearly that they have to industrialize China. In fact, that was generally realized by all Chinese, practically all educated Chinese, for many years. The question is, how do you do that in a country like China? Their economy at present is based upon the countryside. In order to industrialize the cities, you have to draw away from that rural economy. They have come to power by the support of the peasants. How can they industrialize the cities and at the same time retain that peasant support and not put too heavy a burden on the peasants to carry out that industrialization.
One obvious answer to that, I should think, is outside assistance. Is it impossible that America should trade with communist China?
Such trade is going on. The question is, how long will it continue to go on? Will the United States itself accept such an arrangement? We already have an embargo on things precisely which the Chinese communists would like to have.
Well, I think there's another angle to that, too, and that is that the Chinese communists are convinced that our institutions are no use to them. Rightly or wrongly, they feel that we have devolved out of a capitalist society, and therefore they cannot use many of our industrial organization techniques, which actually might be the answer to some of their problems.
I think you're a little sweeping in that, Ravenholt. I don't entirely agree with you. I think they're more eclectic than you suppose.